And so we'll have those numbers soon. So not only targeting a different population, because I think we still should stay true to our mission about the students that we serve, but how do we serve those students to make sure that they're successful in the program or in getting admitted to the program?
So it sounds like we have to begin this program yesterday.
Yesterday. And so over the summer, I've met with the Dean's Council and the College of Education. We've come up with a strategic plan. I've been working with the provost about different opportunities and different ways to do that. I've talked with the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences about different supports for students to be able to pass this test. And so, you know, we're getting a plan together. And one of the things we've also talked about that faculty have been very engaged in, this affects students going into initial teacher preparation programs, whether at the master's level or undergrad level. So we're really also focusing on our graduate programs that are not tied to licensure. And so a lot of curriculum we're probably going through this semester because it only affects licensure programs. So it doesn't affect any other just bachelor non-teaching or master programs non-teaching or even our doctoral program. So we're really looking at different curriculum and different degrees that may have a niche that other institutions don't have that's not tied to a license. In addition to that, we have a reading specialist program, one of the few in the state that we will be putting online, going through the process of putting online, that we'd be able to start in the fall. So we have some things and some initiatives that we hope that will combat some of this, but the reality is those licensure programs are going to be devastating to the enrollment.
Thanks for that information.
Just to,
you know,
if I could ask, on that point, what's the rationale behind the national organization? given that in many of the urban centers, we have this parallel system of charter schools, which can opt out of all of these stringent requirements to be a certified teacher. I mean, it just kind of seems incongruous to me to have this movement for being very specific about where folks are in the testing. In the meantime, you have another whole system where these new schools don't have to have any other kind of certifications for their staff. At the same time, it just...
Well, one, I think this tells you who, and this is, again, just my personal opinion about looking, you know, being in the process, it tells you who they want to teach. The other deans in the state of Illinois in the College of Education, we've written a letter. It's about diversifying the teaching pool. We feel like this would be... there's two messages. They say we want to diversify the teaching pool, but all these obstacles are put into place when we know that standardized tests are biased for socioeconomic reasons, race, gender, and all those things. And so I think the message has been loud and clear about who they want to teach. Secondly, I think, you know, it is two parallels, the charter school movement versus, you know, higher education and traditional teacher preparation in traditional public schools. I think depending on who's going to be in the administration, the White House, that may change again. The current administration, Secretary of Education Duncan, was really pro-charter. I think depending on who's going to be in administration, that may change again. In terms of charter schools, we do know that some of those teachers don't have to have the certification and be safe to practice day one. Unfortunately, if you do look at some of the numbers of charter schools, they're not any more effective than schools, traditional public schools. So I think that's just an internal debate. There's a group of folks who think charter is the way to go. There's a group of folks that think traditional methods are a way to go. But if you look globally, K-12 education is struggling, whether it's charter or the traditional. And I think this accrediting body is really being aggressive in, we really got to get some highly qualified teachers that are safe to practice the first day, and taking extreme measures to do that. There's been a lot of pushback to the point that there are several SPAs, specific professional associations that have pulled out. For example, the elementary education kind of accreditation body has pulled out of this organization. The math accrediting body is also thinking the same because they think that some of these standards are just unattainable. So it's a lot of controversy around it. There are some institutions, actually in Chicago, some smaller private colleges have said they're not going to get the national accreditation. They will only be accredited by Illinois. And so they're not going to even try for getting this accreditation anymore. I don't think that we have that luxury. I think it's important that we stay accredited, especially with the mixed message out there. There's some folks still think the university's not accredited. I think it's very important that we get every accreditation that we need. So it's a big debate. We're hoping that with the advocacy and support that some of these standards will change because clearly it's biased for particular groups that want to go into teaching.
And Trustee Hatch, the standards that Dean Green has referred to that are raising, and Trustee Joyce made reference to, how it's going to become more difficult, this is not something that just started this year. This has been taking place for the last 6 years, and it has happened with Pell Grants and other programs that is limiting the access of higher education to a diverse population. And I'm trying to be politically correct. This is not unique to just the College of Education accreditation process. If you look at Pell Grant for the last 6 years, it has been limiting, it's been taking away the opportunity for diverse populations to get Pell Grant. It scares me when I hear that the federal government is going to move the date up, and if you don't do it by a certain date, then you will not be eligible for Pell. That's what happened to MAP. What happened to a lot of people of diverse population in the state of Illinois? And we told MAP, the state grant, if you move that date, then fewer people of color will apply for MAP. So over the last 5 or 6 years, it has limited the diversity. And I'm very scared of what's gonna happen in the next 4 to 5 years under the auspices of we're raising standards.
Since I was yelling there a little bit ago, let me just say, I was going to say that I don't envy you. Actually, I do. I do envy your position because I think you're confronted with a series of concrete problems that all have solutions to them. And, I'm a firm believer that the foundation is going to produce, and there will be significant dollars there, more than in the past. This is a wonderful campus, a terrific faculty, a wonderful academic rigor, and I'm confident that Dr. You and your staff will get this done. So now that I've taken a blood pressure pill, and I'm good to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I believe this concludes the Academic and Student Affairs Committee report. Thank you.
Maybe we'll postpone the finance and audit until Trustee Zoller returns, and in the interim, we'll take up facilities. Are we ready for a facilities update? Mr. Obersham? Sorry,
good
go
morning,
ahead, sir. Good morning.
Distinguished trustee members and Mr. President. Our resolution that I'm presenting today has to do with Siemens Industry. It pertains to the campus building automation system. And we are looking to actually secure a 3-year contract with Siemens. And that would be not to exceed the amount of $442,000, which would be divided up over the 3-year period. We have secured a approval for a sole source justification, as this company actually, I'm sorry, okay, yes. We have recently secured a sole source justification, as this company has a proprietary rights to our system that we're using. During these 3 years, we intend to have a extensive training with Siemens for our engineers, and so we plan to eventually phase back the amount of service that we're requiring from Siemens. We also have the option to extend the contract for 2 additional years, again, at a cost not to exceed, I believe it's $298,000. And again, that would be divided up over the 2 years. And so we would just like to ask if you all would be so kind as to approve this resolution so that we can secure this 3-year contract.
This is a sole source contract?
Yes, it is.
And could you tell us why it's sole source?
Well, Siemens actually has created this system, and they have proprietary rights, and we're basically required to use their system and their technicians. Okay.
Any questions or comments regarding this contract? I hear a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Trustee Curtin?
Yes.
Trustee Fation?
Yes.
Trustee Hatch?
Yes.
Trustee Joyce?
Yes.
Trustee Leak?
Yes.
Trustee Young?
Yes. Anything else from facilities?
No, that is all.
Thank you.
Or right. Are we tying in? I think we have one more presentation.
Good morning, Board of Trustees, Mr. President,
good morning.
All of the esteemed colleagues. I have a very brief presentation just about the Douglas Hall renovation. You were handed out a presentation that I'm going to give on the screen as well. I was listening to the Republican debates on television, as entertaining as they were, and there was a word resurgence that was there. And this is what I am connotating the renovation of Douglas Hall. To date, we have renovated approximately 112,000 square feet. Just to put that in perspective, the entire JDC building is 115,000 square feet. We have done the entire roof, the first floor in part, the exterior of the building, and the third floor. The picture that you see on the top left is what the first floor used to look like. The top right is what the third floor used to look like. And then what the roof used to look like at the bottom left. And then what the under construction area of the exterior used to look like. We have gone to an eco EPDM roof that is white, which is shown on the right lower hand side. We have actually increased the size of the building by constructing 2-story glass entry atriums, which is helping with our energy efficiency. We replaced all of the windows that were single pane with double pane, low E glazing, allowing for a lower energy usage and a reduction in our heating cost. We also did a restoration of the masonry. We tuck pointed the entire building, the replacement of the concrete lintels and seals and all of the concrete formations, which is represented by the picture that you see at the top left corner. We also renovated our systems. We have now dedicated HVAC systems to serve the third floor. We provided an electrical backup generator. We upgraded our fire alarm systems. We have Wi-Fi and 2 dedicated ITD server rooms on the third floor. We also have LED lighting in every room, as well as occupancy sensors in every room. We also did our HVAC controls automated, and we now have proximity card access to the building, as well as audio visual systems, which are state of the art, providing distance learning, recording, and touchscreen technology. We also made sure that we recognized our interiors so that they can be fabrics of what I call comfort and joy. We have eco flooring, we have split maple wood finishes, epoxy resin, and Corian countertops. We also corrected the deficiencies so that we can make sure that we comply with the current codes. These are, a lot of times the College of Pharmacy is mentioned when we talk about this renovation. However, I'm gonna show you some of the spaces that I also thank Dr. Roundtree and Dr. Britt for helping with this as well. In the College of Health Sciences on the first floor, we renovated about 5,000 square feet, giving them two new classrooms, which hold about 50 persons apiece, with six new offices. The College of Pharmacy on the third floor, we have provided multiple break areas, conference rooms, a student center devoted to our students. We have interdepartmental suites and faculty offices, flexible furniture to encourage both student social engagement and learning, as well as we have three lecture halls now with seating of 100 and plus persons. We have a multi-purpose room, which we're sitting in today, which has seating for over 200. We have other new spaces, which includes five research laboratories, the practice lab, a chapel, and more. So with the management and cost, because this was self-managed without the oversight of the Capital Development Board, I was able to produce a major savings of $500,000. And this all happened during a recession where we could have justifiably stopped the work at least four times, but we continued on. There is now a $16.6 million spend as an investment to our students, staff, and faculty. Thank you for your time. Is there any questions?
Well, on behalf of the entire board, we want to commend you and thank you for the excellent job you've done in shepherding this project through.
Thank you.
I would now like to ask Dean Mobley Smith to come forward and share with us. She has played such a very key role in this facility and bringing it forward. Dean Mobley Smith, would you please come forward? I would also like to acknowledge my predecessor, President Elnora Daniels, who actually played an absolutely key role in positioning this university, not only to have a pharmacy college, but also to have the renovations that we have today. So often people take credit for things. I am not going to take credit for this wonderful renovation. We may have completed it, but it was started by a president named Elnora Daniels, and I want to give her credit for that. Dean Moses Smith, I want you to please tell us what you have here. You did an excellent job. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Obviously, it didn't kill me because I'm sitting here talking, right? It's been strenuous, I will say. You know, we set out on a mission and a journey. The journey is never ending, because we're always looking for ways to make sure that our curriculum is not just standard or adequate, but it's noteworthy and recognized across the country, because that's who we are and that's what we are about. As Monique stated, we were very blessed and fortunate that when the money did come to the university, we were able to manage it instead of the Capital Development Board, because as you know, we have a big ditch out in front of the in the university. That's because the Capital Development Board is managing that project. So by bringing the money in, we were able to keep moving with the project, and we are where we are today. We're almost there. We still have some technology pieces to put together. The students are elated, the faculty are elated. Everyone that's seen the space, including all of you, are pretty elated. And it is a showpiece, I will admit, and we're very, very pleased about it. We have in October official openings of the area. We wanted to set the dates for the time we were sure that every piece of this was going to be completed. And so on October 20th, we will be recognizing Walgreens for their $1 million donation to the program, with the dedication of the red lecture hall. Now, that's how we've kind of come fondly to know where the spaces are. Because it's really funny, as many times as I came up here and some of my staff and faculty will attest to this. I have two hard hats in my office, and I drew pictures on the front of them. One hard hat was the wonderful Miriam with a green beret, like I had been on vacation in France, and I was smiling, and life was good. And so it said Mobley on the top. The other one had a picture with a devil and a pitchfork, and it was written in red, and it said Smith. So anytime I was appearing up here, and I came up here very frequently, and had the Smith hat on, there was a problem. You know, we all don't like to have to come out of ourselves for those kinds of things. But nevertheless, October 20th, Walgreens, the Red Lecture Hall, which is outfitted, what I call for sight, sound, splash, and everything else you want to do. It's lecture capture. It is giving us the ability to have simultaneous instruction. We are not an online program. We have no intention at this point in our strategic plan to become that. There's only just a small handful, under five, in the country that fit that. That's called opening up the accreditation process. That's called doing a whole lot of things that we're not going to do right now. But it doesn't mean that certain parts of our program we cannot have simultaneous instruction. As an example, we can have student case conferences where the students are here, half of them. Others can be at Rush, they could be at U of C, they could be all over. Our faculty member could be at a practice site and conducting it. So all of our students can collectively talk about patient care, patient management, and so on. That's important to us. It gives us state-of-the-art equipment. And so that particular lecture hall will be capable of doing all of that and more. Our CBS Student Center and Technology Laboratory, which would be our second dedication, which is going to occur on Thursday, October 22nd, celebrates a collaboration room and student presentation practice room. Again, it is wired and set up to do just the very things I talked about already with the big lecture hall, but in a much smaller venue, allowing student groups of six or seven to work together on group work, group presentations. Again, the students can collaborate with each other within the cluster, within all the clusters. The faculty members can interact with the students at any point, either in one cluster or all together. And they can also collaborate with individuals away from the university. So we also thought it was very important that the students would have a space that they can prepare for presentations, be they local for their classrooms, or be it for a state meeting, or be it a national venue, a research presentation, or so on. So within that room, we have that capability as well. So as you've seen on the picture, so that's the 22nd. And then on Friday, October 23rd, is the big third floor grand opening where everyone is being invited. You can walk around and see all of the space. And I'll tell you, and I also want to thank Monique and her team for the persistence. And, you know, we maybe haven't been the easiest people to work with sometimes, and because of our expectations being as they are, as we've all had those expectations. But at the end of the day, what you see now has been a labor of love on a number of people's parts, a labor of tenaciousness, because as I frequently tell people over the years, when a lot of passionate people get together, that passion can manifest in different ways because we are all passionate. But when we come together for the good, this is what results. So we're very pleased. We're pleased with all of your support, certainly our university administration, President Watson, Provost Henderson, and all those who came before them. We could not be where we are today without all of those efforts. I thank my executive team. I thank our faculty. I thank our staff and our students who have had a lot of input in terms of where we were going with this. I thank them for their patience, their tenacity, and overall their willingness to bring the best program that this university could bring in terms of pharmacy education to the South Side of Chicago. Thank you very much.
Provost, could you please, in 30 seconds, no more, tell phase two, the virtual hospital, the seven, Monique, is it 7.5 million?
These are the four plans at the top of what we are pursuing.
Tell them what it is. They don't know what a virtual hospital is.
With that, there's a number of the departments that can come together, and not just necessarily nursing, but nursing and pharmacology and the different ones. So we do want to create a hospital environment where we have an actual nurses station so that when you come in, it actually does look like a hospital. But then also we have learning spaces that mock trauma centers or ER rooms. And then on the first floor, we're going to actually put our wellness center. So we have a wellness center on campus, and on the first floor, we're going to actually put the wellness center so they can begin to expand their programs, too. We're needing $8 million more in order to do everything that we are endeavoring to do. So we appreciate the support of Donnie Trotter, and we appreciate the support of the board and everyone involved to continue to try to finance the remainder of the project.
I just want to say, under the leadership of Dr. Leslie Roundtree, who is an occupational therapist, Dean Mobley Smith, who is a pharmacist, with my expertise as an ICU nurse and a nurse manager and in hospital administration, with Dr. Britt as a medical doctor, and we can go on and on, Lisa Young as advanced practice nurse, we have the expertise in-house to provide the support to build a state-of-the-art virtual hospital on the south side of Chicago under the leadership of our project manager, Monique Corden, who did a great job here, as well as everybody else in-house and with your support. So we can do this in the next 5 years. And in addition to serving our students, it could be a revenue center. Pharmacy already will be providing revenue services to other pharmacists across the country. Will be a revenue center. And then we also want to be a simulated hospital so that if an emergency takes place on the south side of Chicago, the city of Chicago could utilize this space as a setting to serve those in need. So we look forward to keeping you updated.
Thank you. I'm sorry we skipped, quite frankly, to the simulated hospital so fast, because I personally wanted to thank Dean Mobley Smith for just being an inspiration to so many, for having such wonderful oversight and commitment to your program and to the university, and for reaching out and collaborating with so many others that CSU's name is now just noted with pharmacy. And I've had the pleasure recently of working with members, faculty members on your staff. Amazing. They're amazing people. It just brings so much joy to me to know that we have this under you. Thank you so much.
At this time, we'll move to our legislative and human resource update. Trustee Leake.
Yes, we have a good
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Tom Wogan, Director of Public Relations for the University. I just wanted to give a brief update on the state of legislative affairs in Illinois. Trustee Curtin, you might want to ready another blood pressure pill.
Once a day is good.
Maybe a half one, I don't know.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wogan, for your concern.
Okay, so just a brief update on the legislative session. Obviously, we are into the fourth month of the overtime session without a budget. And unfortunately, I have to report that there really has not been significant progress towards a final resolution on the state budget at this point. The stalemate is very much still a stalemate. So despite the lack of a state budget, just to give some context of where we're at and why public university funding is becoming closer and closer to a very dire situation here. So despite the lack of a state budget, many state operations do continue to function, and the state is still spending money on payroll and services. So a combination of factors that include the agreed-upon K-12 education budget, which we spoke about at the last meeting, a series of judicial orders and consent decrees, which have mandated various spending on human services, and Governor Rauner's decision to continue meeting the state payroll, all has resulted in roughly 90% of the state of state funds already being either spent or legally committed moving forward. So there's 10% of the money left, and obviously the state university system has not received any money. So we have to be funded out of that 10%, and we are rushing very much towards a literal fiscal cliff in terms of, and we're not the only ones in there either. There's other human service funding that needs to be addressed. There's significant veteran service funding that needs to be addressed. So it's not like public university is the only thing sitting out there either. So the situation is getting definitely more dire. So over these past several months, CSU, we're starting to see an increased amount of questions from the staff members of the legislative caucuses, as well as the governor's office, starting to really specifically ask how this fiscal situation is going to impact the university moving forward. Different universities are answering in different ways. Some are being more vague, some are being more specific, but all of it really boils down to that the situation gets more dire for all universities as we get closer to the end of the calendar year. And while everybody is doing everything we can to protect our students and to continue doing the necessary academic work that needs to be done, and we're trying to allow for the process to, trying to allow for the legislature and the governor to let this process reach some sort of conclusion, time is running short. And we are all the universities, including Chicago State, are going to reach a point eventually where it's going to become very difficult to do basic functions, meet payroll, continue literally keeping the lights on. So, you know, I would not have said this in May, nor June, or even July, but we had a conversation the last time I came before this board about how many people thought that the K-12 education budget in August might become sort of where the crisis becomes a reality and that actually spurs action. It's starting to look like public universities might be very much part of the crisis, where we start to see something dire enough happen that forces some sort of action out of the two sides. Right now, the shutdown doesn't really feel like a shutdown, and so that has led to a situation where no one feels compelled to act. So, in addition to the lack of the state budget, there are also two important components of financial assistance to our students that are in limbo. We've obviously, you're aware, the MAP grants have not been funded. There's no guarantee that those funds will be made available to the to CSU or other public universities in the normal December timeframe. So CSU, along with the other eight public institutions, have made a decision to allow students who rely on MAP to register for classes, operate business as normal, in the hope that we're going to get a resolution before the normal time frame that those funds would have become available for the end of the semester, especially as we have to consider moving into spring. So if that does not happen, if there is no resolution, either the university or the student is ultimately going to be responsible for those MAP grant funds. The same could be said for the $1.6 million in merit scholarships. We're allowing students to continue with the assumption that there will be some resolution at some point. But if that resolution doesn't come, we get to the end of the calendar year, we're looking into registration into spring, some very, very difficult questions and not very many good answers are going to be on the table. Capital projects, obviously, same boat here. All capital projects through the Capital Development Board remain frozen. You all walked by a very large ravine of construction work on the way into this building today. That is one very visible example. We have communicated to the governor's office several times that stalling these projects create potential future costs. They potentially increase costs by stalling them. At the moment, though, we shouldn't expect to see any capital funding until we see some sort of resolution in the overall budget process. So as far as advocacy, members of the CSU community continue to advocate on behalf of the university during a critical time. I've had several students, faculty, staff contact my office for talking points and contact numbers for lawmakers. And while this is an extremely difficult time and this impasse is causing a great deal of concern, it is heartening to see members of the university that it spurs them into action, makes some visible showing of how much they care about this school and wanting to see funding for it. So, also, I just wanted to point out on Wednesday, as part of some increased advocacy, there's two increased advocacy efforts that are going on. I'm actually getting on a conference call in about 20 minutes here with the other public university liaisons as we discuss what our next step in ramping up some pressure on the governor and the legislative leaders around the crisis that we're facing. We will be participating in a press conference next Wednesday. We're going to bring a student and an administrator down. State Treasurer Mike Frericks has called the press conference in an attempt to put a spotlight on the MAP grant problem. And so we are going to be trying to get some earned media around that in the hopes of just getting our case out there as much as possible. In your board report, I won't go through everything in the legislation section of your board report. There have been some legislative pieces that have been introduced that are worth the board's attention. Specifically, SB 2043 is the MAP grant funding bill. It separated out just the money from MAP grant into a single piece of legislation. It has passed the Senate. I have had conversations with the House sponsor. She intends to move it. The governor has said he is opposed to continuing these piecemeal spending. However, the governor has shown an open mind to these issues in case by case. So our hope is he shows an open mind to the necessity of MAP grant funding. There have been some bills introduced in regards to future reforms on presidential compensation, things of that nature. Since this board is the only university in the state in a presidential search right now, there are proposed reforms that may or may not affect whatever agreements reached with the next president of CSU, but are still worth looking at in terms of kind of what's on the mind of the legislators as they consider presidential compensation. It has been very much in the news lately for issues that have nothing to do with CSU, but still have driven it to the top of the news, the news cycle. And that pretty much concludes my report. I would just suggest, I don't want to go through all the details of the legislative pieces that have been introduced, but they are in the board report. I would just suggest they're worth a once over from the board members. And Tom, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Tom, I don't know if my question is better asked to you or to Patrick, but
probably to me. I'm kidding.
I heard you say that 90% of the budget monies allocations have already been allocated. 90% of
Correct.
The monies have already been allocated. And much of that is because there was court order. Are we as a collective of universities, state institutions, thinking of a lawsuit at all?
There has been in a very broad discussion amongst the other public university liaisons and attorneys, there's been some chatter of it, but nothing that has risen to the level of a serious consideration. I've had
why not?
Well, I just think that the tone hasn't switched to that level of severity. Perhaps you could argue that it should at this stage, but just speaking amongst my conversations with the other liaisons of the nine universities, there's still sort of a mindset of we're working towards a resolution within the normal budget process.
Except for this is not a normal budget process.
No, it's not.
90% of it is already gone.
And just to add on to the severity of that, it's 90% spent on a spending plan that is already in deficit. So just it's 90% it's 90% of a spending plan that would assume roughly $38 billion budget, but there's only $33 to $34 billion in revenue. So no matter what, there's not going to be enough money. And my fear is that, and I think this is the fear of all the public universities, is that we'll reach a point where we wind up with a 50-60% cut by nature of that's all that's left.
Right. So for me, for whatever that's worth, it seems irresponsible to not move to the courts ASAP.
Well, what I can say, Trustee Zoller, is that we're going to have conversations here today about what the next steps are, and I will definitely bring that to the table as a possibility. There is also a potential consideration outside of working, the nine public universities are trying to work together to keep a unified voice. Keeping nine entities on the same page on anything is very difficult, obviously. There may, legally speaking, I know some attorneys who would tell you that Chicago State University might have a case to be made, given that we serve an underserved population with relatively few options outside of Chicago State, that we might have an opportunity to create some pressure legally that way. Again, I'm not an attorney. I like to pretend I am, but I am not. But I just know from speaking with some other attorneys that we as just speaking for our institution, it might be
need
something we want to consider moving down the road here.
Because as the president says, there's a disparate impact.
Exactly.
Which speaks to what we said earlier. Our student body is so different from any other university, which is why our students are impacted in a great way when they don't have money, they can't go to school. And the disparate impact, which is what Tom is talking about and Trustee Zoeller is talking about, puts our university possibly in a unique situation where we might be able to. Patrick?
Well, I don't think that's an appropriate conversation for this body. And so there has been some conversations among the various general counsels. I can say that there is not a consensus that has emerged in terms of bringing lawsuit. And I can go do a deeper dive in terms of a potential lawsuit brought by Chicago State in executive session.
Thank you.
There is a potentially, I guess, some ways we can turn our negative situation to a positive. I mean, one is to get out the unique story of Chicago State. I mean, I was thinking, liaisons have planned a press conference in Springfield, which is a small media market. Maybe consider the state schools in the Chicago region doing something with a much larger media market, especially talking about the MAP program, which, I'm just figuring out what that is. We used to call it Illinois State Scholarship back in the day. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be sitting here without that. So,
agreed.
To talk about that this is a part of the state budget crisis as well, because, I mean, I think politically, neither of the political entities in the General Assembly or the executive branch thought that they could get away with elementary and high schools shutting down. So that started, of course, the process of funding certain things and taking the pressure off of negotiating environment. But so that piece, and then I think also, I mean, you've got some interesting civil rights organizations, and Urban League comes to mind,
okay,
here in Chicago, that we might want to consider kind of getting ahead of this story, at least in the Chicago area, talking about what this means politically to certain challenged communities. Chicago State offers disproportionately a great amount of opportunity for folks who wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity. So what does it look like us kind of proactively in this environment, using it to get our unique story out with some interesting partners that here in the Chicago area might help us to kind of get that story out? And it's part of the dialogue, the political dialogue on the budget. Do we really want to decimate all of the state universities, number one? Mm-hmm. Probably not. I don't think anybody thinks that's a good outcome. And do we want to take away this one opportunity in particular that a lot of students and families that already have unique sets of challenges, with Chicago State helps in particular, we can't afford 50%, we can't afford 30%. And even with the enrollment management report today, 500 students who, because of lack of ability to pay, are not here. So just maybe some creative ways that the liaisons in this region can talk about the state budget impact and kind of move the higher education issue higher in the conversation about the state budget.
Agree 100%. All good ideas.
There's a new executive director over at the Urban League. I think she's been in place just maybe 6 weeks or something. I met her a few weeks ago. I don't know who else might be a good voice to kind of add on to this to talk about.
But to your point, yes, community, yes, I think we have up until now, through a lot of this process, like I said, the nine universities have tried to been speaking with a singular voice. My concern, quite frankly, is that we've reached a point where we're not, I was explaining to the president the other day, we were having this conversation. We almost are sort of punished by the fact that we weren't the most immediate crisis. By nature of being a state university, we did not on June 30th say we're going to have to shut our doors and everything is going to have to screech to a halt. Just by the nature of the way that universities are set up, we were able to continue. So what happened was the immediate crisis got taken care of. K-12, human services, piece by piece, state payroll, state police, prisons, all those things keep getting paid. And so because our house was not on fire first, and this money kept going out the door, we almost wind up being punished by the fact that we had a cash position. We were able to keep operating, and as a result. So, nine universities have nine boards, nine presidents, different chancellors, a lot of different minds in the room. Not everyone's necessarily always rowing in the same direction at the same time. So to your point, I 100% agree that we've reached a point where if that advocacy is not reaching the heights that we need to see it, then yes, we need to engage our community stakeholders. We need to go and
NAACP is the other one I was trying.
Absolutely. Our community stakeholders, the folks who know what this university is and its value, and I will probably as we start to formulate a little bit more of an aggressive plan here, I'll probably be reaching out to the folks up here on this dais I'll have some asks of the board members in terms of advocacy moving forward, just because I think we're reaching an all hands on deck level of potential crisis here. It's real. The crisis is very much real. Eventually, we're going to reach a point where we can't function.
And the point again with the other universities, a 30% cut, 15% cut, would affect us much
differently.
More.
Much deeper
than others, and so we might need to think of our own PR strategy to kind of break out of the camp here to make sure that people understand what this crisis means for Chicago State. It would be much more devastating than even the other universities, and what would some of the partners look like who could help us to make that case, along with students and faculty.
Agreed.
That can be voices to talk about, turn our negative into a positive. It's a bad environment, but we have an interesting story that we might be able to get some traction in the middle of it.
Agreed.
Question. You and your counterparts meet?
Weekly.
Routinely?
Yes. There's a weekly phone call with all the liaisons, presidents and chancellors, either myself, usually it's myself, the president, and Mr. Pinkleton participate in that call.
Are
so,
are you in crisis mode now?
Very much so.
Sorry.
Very much so, yes. Yes.
And what, as we as trustees, what can we do as far as the happenings in Springfield, the meetings with the particular legislators that we may have a relationship with? Are you asking for any of that assistance?
Absolutely, and as I said, I have been very heartened to be contacted by many members of the CSU family who want talking points, information, and I'll be happy to share with the board what I've been sharing with members of the community who've asked. And absolutely, I would highly suggest. Now, I think most of the people on the board probably don't need me to tell you what to say about why this university is important. You probably have a pretty good understanding of that already. However, I'd be happy to share with the talking points, the general points I've been sharing with the community.
Do you have that document that we could have share that with us?
Absolutely, yes, okay. Yes. And then what I've been doing is disseminating that along with office numbers for the Senate and House members of the Higher Education Appropriations Committees, because I just feel like that's as good a starting point in terms of contacting the legislators who are going to be the ones in the room when, if and when we finally get to some sort of final negotiation here. But yes, I'll be happy to share that.
Okay, I don't know if anyone else has any questions. If not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
That brings our legislative and human resources update to a close. At this time, do we have a report from the Civil Service Merit Board, Trustee Hatch?
Yeah, just a brief one. But on that point again, because I was just making a mental note again, we had 500 students, roughly, who could not return because of financial reasons, which is directly tied to this environment. 57% of our students, first generation, 59% at or below the poverty level. I mean, our story is one that could and should break out of the pack even from the other state universities. It's what this environment means to people who are facing the most challenges. So, you know, just back on that again, 500 students who could not return because of all of the uncertainty about the MAP program. So that it's a story that needs to get told. And we need to, I think, also try to figure out how to use being in the largest media market in the state and one of the largest in the country, getting this story out about urban college education and opportunities for people facing challenges. I mean, breaking out of the pack of the state university story is my point.
Trustee Hatch, I'm in 100% agreement with everything you stated. I just have to correct one fact because I don't want it to go into the record. We started out with about 500, but the staff worked to get that number down to about 200. So only about 200 students could not actually return. We started out at 500, Provost.
Carol? I thought she said 800. And then we whittled it down to five.
Five.
We whittled it down to five. And then the students were continually reinstated until we got to a point.
It was two.
Where it was about 200.
Okay, 200. Got it. All right.
Okay. I just didn't want.
Yes.
For fact, I just want anybody to say five. So
I don't want to say the wrong thing.
Okay.
Even though five sounds more dramatic.
but it also does not take into account.
Yeah, one is too many.
It does not take into account the hard work that the staff
absolutely
put forward.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of whittling it down from eight to five and from five to 200.
And the university having to front the MAP money.
Yeah.
I mean, just shows extraordinary commitment.
Yes.
Again, I mean, that needs to be one of the centerpiece points of discussions in the state negotiations, you know, gunning these kind of opportunities for people with great challenges already. Is that the kind of state we want to live in? And so that, I mean, something I think people on both sides of the aisle would be interested in having that conversation. Mr. Chairman, if I made a brief report, I made my first meeting on Wednesday with the Merit Board. It was a baptism of fire of sorts. That board was right in the middle of making a decision on a new executive director. There had been an executive director in place about 15 years. And so we did on my first meeting following the recommendation of the search team, we hired Jeff Brownfield, who was the assistant director, will become the new director of the executive director of the Merit Board. So that was the first and only order of business that we had on Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, we would normally have our student trustee report, but we will not have a report at this meeting because since school just started, the student trustee will not have a report until our next meeting. And at this time, I'll entertain a motion to recess into executive session.
So moved.
I second.
Trustee Curtin?
Yes.
Trustee Fation?
Yes.
Trustee Hatch?
Yes.
Trustee Joyce?
Yes.
Trustee Leak?
Yes.
Trustee Young?
Yes.
Trustee Zoller?
Yes.